1998, 15 charter schools opened in Ohio. 13 years later, more than 300 schools are up and running to the tune of more than $500 million in state funds this year. They are serving more than 113,000 students this year, about one out of every 15 public school students, that is. They were supposed to offer an alternative, create some competition, and give children otherwise destined for failing schools a chance to succeed. So how are charter schools doing in Ohio? Coming up, we'll get some reaction from a couple of different points of view. Right now, we welcome two reporters from State Impact Ohio. State Impact Ohio is a website and radio program covering education in Ohio from the classroom to the Capitol. It's a collaboration of NPR and WOSU, WCPN, and WKSU. Joining us, Molly Bloom. She's a Kent-based reporter for State Impact Ohio. She's covered education and other beats for the Austin American-Statesman and the Newark Star-Ledger. A New Jersey native, she has a bachelor's degree in history from Princeton University. Molly Bloom, are you with us?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us, Molly. Also with us, Ida Liaskowski. She's a reporter with State Impact Ohio. Ida covered a variety of topics for WCPN in Cleveland, her hometown, before heading out west to cover state government for Capital Public Radio in California. She has a bachelor's degree in journalism and psychology from Miami University. Welcome, Ida, to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
There are three basic types of charter schools in Ohio: community-run, for-profit, company-managed, and public school-sponsored. You're covering all three of those in a three-part series that started today on Ohio Public Radio. Tell us about those three basic types, Ida.
Sure. So there are three basic types of ways to run a charter school. The first one that we talked about today was community schools that are run by nonprofits and community members. And that's probably the oldest type. The first charter school in Ohio was run that way. Tomorrow you'll hear about some public schools that initially were really against charter schools but are sort of now getting on board with the charter school train and are sponsoring their own schools. If they sponsor school, it doesn't mean that they run the school on a day-to-day basis, but they provide support services and some accountability for those schools. And you'll hear about an example like a school like that tomorrow. And then the third type is the management companies that run the schools as for-profit institutions. And that means that while they run the school as a school, they also get to make a little bit of money off of it. And there's some questions around how those operate, and you'll hear about those on Wednesday.
When you say little bit of money, do we know how much little bit of money?
Well, the thing is that most of those companies are private companies, so they don't have to disclose how much money they make. So we don't know. Some people take guesses, but that's really part of the discussion around those schools is that we don't know. And, for example, with White Hat Management, which is one of the largest for-profit charter school operators in the state, 10 of their own school boards are suing them because the school boards don't know how much money they make or where that money goes and how that money is spent. So that's where a lot of the questions around those schools lie.
That's the for-profit you were just talking about. For the not-for-profits, do we know how much it costs them? Do they get enough money from the state per student to do the jobs that they want to do?
Well, some say they don't. Some say they do, that they do a good enough job with it. On average, they get around $5,200 per student for a charter school, which is a bit less than what the public schools get. And on top of that, they can get all sorts of federal grants and state grants to help them round out the amount that they spend on students. But the idea that these charter schools get less funding than traditional public schools was sort of the idea behind charter schools in the first place, that they would get a bit less funding. But in exchange for that, they don't have to adhere to the same rules and regulations that traditional public schools do. Those include things like providing transportation or certain size cafeterias or certain size gymnasiums, that sort of thing.
Molly Bloom, last week you wrote about the WKSU report on the Rootstown School District that plans to open a charter school on the campus of the Northeast Ohio Medical University. What kind of school is that? And it sounds very specialized. Are those? Is there an increase in those kinds of schools?
That is a STEM school that focuses on getting sort of more diverse students into schools focusing on science, technology, engineering, and math. And the idea is to sort of increase the pool of students, especially going into the healthcare fields. And that's sort of in larger charter schools and an increasing number of traditional public schools do have these sort of specialized focuses that are part of, you know, this trend to try to keep kids engaged in school and address, you know, get families interested in picking a school that they think suits their kids.
My guests are Ida Liaskovsky. She's a reporter with State Impact Ohio. Also, Molly Bloom, another reporter with State Impact Ohio. We're talking about charter schools. If you have a question or comment for our reporters, we welcome them. 614-292-8513 is the number to call. If you'd like to email us, allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and check us out there. 614-292-8513, though, if you want to give us a call right now. So does the proliferation of charter schools in Ohio mean that more kids are getting a better education now? We talked about the fact that 13 years ago, you know, there were just 15 schools. Now there's more than 300 charter schools. Ida?
Does it mean that they're getting a better education?
Right. Does it mean that many more children are getting a better education in Ohio now that they have that option?
Well, I think the answer to the question of whether or not charter schools are working is sort of the answer to the question of whether or not public schools are working. I mean, some do a fantastic job and educate kids in amazing ways and truly unique ways, and some don't do quite as well. If you look at the overall statistics, charter schools tend to perform about the same or maybe a little bit better than the nearby traditional public schools. And I think the thing with charter schools is that some are fantastic and some work for certain students, and some aren't that great and some don't work for certain types of students. So I think a lot of it depends on what type of learner the student is. The thing about charter schools is that they can use pretty unique ways of teaching kids. They don't have to have a set curriculum the way that traditional public schools do. So I think for students that find a charter school that meets their needs, it can be wonderful. But that's not a guarantee with a charter school, just like it's not a guarantee with any school, really.
Most of the schools that tend to be on the lower end of the scale in terms of their success, public schools, just regular traditional public schools, tend to be located in big urban school districts. Is that where most of the successful charter schools are located as well?
Well, almost all charter schools are located in urban districts because okay. That's the way Ohio's laws were set up. Charter schools were sort of supposed to target the exactly that student population that was struggling in these big urban school districts that weren't doing too well. And so charter schools really proliferated in urban areas around failing public school districts, the idea being that if your public school doesn't give you a good option, here's another option. Here's your charter school that's technically a public school, but it's run a little bit differently, has a little bit more freedom and a little bit more creativity in how it can run its school. So maybe that will do a better job.
And Molly, I think you sent me a note. You said of note about Columbus and Franklin County has the most charter schools of any county in Ohio with 63 at last count. Is that just a reflection of the fact that Columbus happens to have the biggest school district in the state?
I think that certainly plays into it. I mean, in general, Columbus's charter schools do a little bit better than the traditional public schools in Columbus. But it's not a huge difference. So I'm not sure if that, you know, performance difference plays into things or if it's just a population thing and also a growth issue.
Are you, to what extent are people better informed about their local charter schools nowadays? You know, like you said, last, you know, 13 years ago, there were just 15 schools. It was easy to educate yourself. Now you're saying there's 63 alone in Franklin County alone. So how does a consumer figure that out?
Now, I think that's a really good question because I think when you talk to parents about how they pick a school, they often talk about how the school makes them feel, that they feel like, you know, teachers at the school care about their children. They feel like the administrators are welcoming. You know, it has a nice building. They don't necessarily talk about, well, you know, 50% of the fifth graders are on grade level in math, or, you know, the school's rating, which sort of says something about how parents make decisions and how much the information is pushed out there. There are report cards on every charter school that are available on the Ohio Department of Education's website, and the performance data that's reported is the same mostly as for traditional public schools. So that information is there, but it's not always the first information that's pushed out to parents.
And I think the other piece of this is that because charter schools are in urban districts, those happen to be the areas that have the most safety concerns. And for many parents, safety comes first. It really comes ahead of everything. If their child is safe and they don't have to have a long commute to school or a long walk to school and that school has police there 24/7, then, you know, they're going to pick that school regardless of academics, or maybe academics won't be the top concern. It's definitely a concern, but not the top concern. So as long as the school is safe and nearby and convenient, that's a big factor for many parents, understandably. And the other thing is that charter schools have big budgets for marketing. Many charter schools do a much better job of marketing themselves and advertising to nearby local parents than traditional public schools do, or even maybe some private schools.
Are they allowed to spend their public money on marketing?
Oh, yeah.
Is that part of their mission?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They can really, you know, more or less spend the money whatever way they want. That's kind of the deal, is that they can spend their money on certain things, and that's up to them, to, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned safety concerns, and one thing I wanted to ask was whether or not a charter school has to take everybody who applies to take them, as long as they have room for them.
Technically, yes. Technically, charter schools are public schools, and they are open to everyone that wants to go there. Many charter schools will do things like they'll have a minimum GPA, or they'll target special needs students. So there are ways that charter schools can sort of target themselves towards a certain student population, but they can't refuse anyone.
Well, you said they have a minimum GPA. Doesn't that automatically refuse people?
Yes, and public school folks will tell you that if a charter school does something like that, then they are being exclusive and they're not serving that public school function the way that traditional public schools are. But technically, they're not supposed to be able to turn anyone away for really any reason.
Is the jury still out, or do we know that charter schools are safer places for children? Because they certainly don't, for instance, have the economies of scale of a big school district like Columbus when it comes to Toledo or anywhere when it comes to providing security services.
Right. And I think this depends on the charter school. Some charter schools in certain areas have, you know, full-time police officers that are in the schools monitoring student safety. And the other piece of this, I think, is just location. Some of these charter schools are just in a better location for many of these parents, where the students don't have to walk through a bad neighborhood or don't have to walk for as long. And that in itself is a safety element. So it really depends. It varies greatly, I think.
We're talking about charter schools in Ohio. It's been 13 years. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Joining me right now, Molly Bloom. She's a Kent-based reporter for State Impact Ohio. And also Ida Liaskowski. She is a Cleveland-based reporter for State Impact Ohio. And coming up, we'll hear from Terry Ryan of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and Foundation. And also Stephen Dyer. He's an education policy fellow at Innovation Ohio. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In the 10 years since the U.S. military began fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, civilians and veterans have begun to see the war in different ways. Paul Taylor, editor of a Pew study on the gap, says the moment is unique.
We've never fought a war in which such a small share of the population has carried the fight.
I'm Neil Conan. The growing gulf between those watching the wars and those fighting them. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation comes your way starting at 2 o'clock this afternoon here at 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the McCoy Center for the Arts, collaborating with the King's Art Complex to bring the talents and theatrical experience of the Dance Theater of Harlem to the McCoy Center on Tuesday, October 18th. Tickets and details at mccoycenter.org.
Checking the weather forecast for Central Ohio. Partly sunny today with a high of about 81 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 55. Then on Tuesday, partly sunny, a high of 72 expected tomorrow. Tuesday night, a chance of showers, mostly cloudy, low of 56, cooler weather moving in. Wednesday will have a chance of rain and mostly cloudy skies and a high of 70 degrees.
Joining us now to continue our conversation about charter schools on All Sides with Ann Fisher is Terry Ryan. Terry is Vice President for Ohio Programs and Policy at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and Foundation. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ann, for having me.
Also with us is Stephen Dyer. Stephen is the Education Policy Fellow at Innovation Ohio. It's a liberal think tank in Columbus. Stephen was the chairman of the subcommittee that produced the evidence-based school funding model, which was a school funding system that evaluated each state school district and appropriated a funding stream for it. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be here.
And still with us, Molly Bloom with State Impact Ohio, and also Ida Liakovsky. She is also with State Impact Ohio. They have a three-part series that started airing today on Ohio Public Radio, including WOSU. So you can check that out on our website at WOSU.org/allsides to get more information about that. And you could just go to WOSU.org and hear the story as well. 614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment for our guests. Stephen, in testimony recently before the Senate Education Committee, you said that most of the 23 highest-ranking charter schools all serve specialized populations of students. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about that a little bit earlier, and I was wondering what you think the significance is in that, why that's important to know.
Well, and I think it's important to kind of look at, you know, now that we're this far out from the beginning of this experiment, I mean, in the beginning it was an experiment, to take a look at what seems to work in Ohio for charters. And when you look at the highest performing charter schools, a lot of them are specialized schools. They're serving, arts, or they're in career tech, or some other specialized form of curriculum. And I think what that, you know, the kind of the idea behind the charter school was to start an incubator for creativity and innovation, and a lot, you know, try to do some things outside the box. And I think what you're finding in Ohio is that the idea of a specialized school started in the community is they are doing very well. The problem is that there is a huge disparity between the highest performing charter schools and the lowest performing charter schools. I mean, the disparity on the performance index score is greater, for instance, than the disparity between, say, Indian Hill or Dublin and Cleveland. So you can imagine, you know that disparity, the disparity in charter schools is even greater. So I think what we have to do is start figuring out what works in Ohio for charter schools, and let's make sure that those charter schools are able to flourish and thrive and do well, and see what we can do about the ones that are really struggling.
Terry Ryan, the disparity that Stephen just talked about, what do you make of it, and what are charter schools able to learn from each other about why one succeeds and one doesn't? They all get the same amount of money right per student, ostensibly.
So first, the disparity. There is disparity in achievement, and partly we've been tracking this data for 10 years. A lot of the newer schools do struggle, and it takes 3-4 years to get a good school up and running on average. That's what we're coming to appreciate. By the third year, you should see that a school is starting to perform. So the timing of things matters. Also, the student population Stephen talks about, and some of the best charter schools that we work with and that we know well are serving the neediest kids in the community, whether that be in Dayton or that be in Cleveland. I mean, they're serving the kids who are coming from the toughest neighborhoods and have the toughest needs, and the school fits their need, maybe because it's a longer day, a longer school year. They're able to do some things with flexibility because they don't have union contracts, so that they're able to in effect, have extended learning time and these sorts of things. And then the second question you asked me, I'm sorry, I forget already.
Is what do they learn from each other after 13 years? Do they learn anything?
They do, absolutely. So you have a group up in Cleveland called Breakthrough Schools, and they started out with three school types, three very different types. One was a more traditional, sort of rigorous, the kids would be in line and they'd have uniforms on, and it was basically a very traditional three R's. And then you had a much more sort of easygoing type school, and both of them were serving their children very well and delivering great results. And what they decided, though, is they could work together to get economy of scale. And so they have a centralized office for business services and these sorts of things. And as they grow, they're able to grow different models of schools that meet the needs of the kids in the community where they're operating. And so they've learned how to work together, how to get shared services together, how to get economy of scale together. We're seeing more of that. And we're not seeing that only among charter schools. We're seeing that among charter schools and some school districts that are taking advantage of the charter school law. The highest performing high school in Dayton is a charter school that the Dayton Public Schools authorize. It's the Dayton Early College Academy. It's a fantastic model. The University of Dayton supports it. The business community supports it. The Dayton Public Schools support it.
Ida or Molly, we talked about Terry just mentioned that the newer schools tend to be the ones that struggle the most, and I'm wondering, what do you know about the parents who send their kids to newer charter schools, and why do they take that risk? Ida?
Yeah, well, the thing about new charter schools is that some of them are new, but like Terry mentioned, they're part of a bigger organization. So that Breakthrough Charter Schools that he talked about in Cleveland, they open a lot of new schools. But they're not that new because they're following a model that's sort of tried and tested and has worked out quite well. So for those parents, they have the comfort of saying, well, I'm sending my kids to a new school that just opened this year, but that school is run by a group that already has 3, 4, 5 successful charter schools that run similarly or run the same way. So that allays some of those fears. And I think the other thing is that in many cases, even where the charter school isn't tried and tested and true, maybe, trying something new might be a good alternative if your child is really having trouble at the school that they're at. I think it really depends on how bad things are for your student in their current situation.
In your story today, you went to Toledo to visit the first charter school open in Ohio 13 mm-hmm. years ago, and it talks about the divide between public schools and nearby charters. And Stephen Dyer, he referred to that, the Ohio charter wars, in his testimony recently before the Senate Education Committee. What did you find? Do you agree there's an Ohio charter wars out there, or what did you find?
Well, I think it's real interesting because both sides tend to feel like there's a war going on, and both sides sort of say that they wish there wasn't. Charter schools say that they're constantly attacked by public school districts for taking money away, public school districts that allege that charter schools do take money away from the public school district, and they deplete their student population as well, which is a big problem in a lot of big urban districts. And what I'm hearing a lot from both sides is that people sort of wish the conversation would shift not from charter schools versus public schools to instead, what's a good school, regardless of the model and the funding mechanism? It's what makes a good school, because there are good charter schools and there are good public, traditional public schools. And I think the question that everyone's starting to ask now is what makes those schools good, and not necessarily how they're funded or how they're run. But the animosity is still definitely strong. In Toledo at Aurora Academy, which was at school profile today, the oldest charter school in the state, just a couple years ago, the Toledo Public School Teachers Union protested outside the school. So that animosity still definitely exists. But I think the conversation is slowly starting to change.
Is that what you found, Stephen Dyer, as well?
Well, let me just say that, you know, I think a lot of this would be solved if the state would look at alternative methods of funding charter schools. And, you know, the way it's done right now is if a kid goes to a traditional public school and decides to go to a charter, the state transfers the money that would have gone to that district to the charter school. The problem is the money that would have gone to that kid in the traditional school is significantly less because the state takes into account what you can raise locally before it sends you the money. So in a lot of cases, more state money goes with the kid to the charter school than would have gone to the kid in the traditional school. So for instance, in the Big 8 school districts, they lose about 20% of their population to charter schools, but they lose about 28% of their state money to charter schools. And that's really a function of charter schools not being able to raise local revenue. And that's a problem. And this all goes back to the unconstitutional funding system we've had for a long time, where we rely too much on property taxes. So when the state transfers money, necessarily there's a problem because most of the funding for education in this state is done through local property taxes, and the charter schools can't raise that. So, you know, one of the things that was done in the last House Bill 1 was creating a school funding advisory
council. State budget, yeah.
Yeah. And the school funding advisory council, there was a charter and traditional school cooperation and collaboration subcommittee. And the first thing they recommended was the state directly fund charter schools, fund the kid where they go to school rather than doing this transfer. The transfer has really led to a lot of animosity between charter school between traditional public schools and charter schools because the traditional schools, and some of them are rated very excellent. And that's what Senate Bill 175 is all about. You know, you've got a school district like Boardman that's rated excellent, excellent with distinction. They're losing to $100,000 to $1 million a year to community schools in their area that are not rated as well. And that's starting to lead to some frustration. And I think that if the state would look at other ways of doing it, I'm not saying it's easy. Having been in it, I know it's not easy. But I think that there needs to be a less acrimonious way of funding them in order to get over a lot of that historical angst between the two sides.
Terry Ryan, do you agree that the funding stream is an issue that needs to be at least looked at?
Funding is an issue. I want to go back to the notion of the charter war, though, because I think that we're actually making progress. Again, I'll point to Cleveland, where the Cleveland district schools have actually been working with high-performing charters up there and authorizing them, giving birth to them, overseeing them, trying to figure out ways to help encourage their development. Now, they're doing that because these are high-performing schools, and they believe that the seats that the schools will provide will be excellent ones, and it's where you want kids to go. These things are happening in other districts as well. I mean, there are over 40 districts in the state of Ohio that are authorizing birthing charter schools, and they have relationships. I mentioned the Dayton Early College Academy in Dayton, and Columbus has a partnership here with some high-performing charter schools, some that they've given birth to, some that they themselves just support because they know they're high quality. It comes back to quality. I think educators, no matter if they're charter educator or district educators, they're really good ones. All they care about is providing quality seats to kids. And if a charter can do that better than a district school, they'll support it. Funding certainly has been a thorn in the side because of what Stephen was referring to, that you basically have funds that the districts say,
it's
hey,
robbing Peter,
we're
Peter
bleeding,
to pay Paul,
right, we're bleeding them. Now, I could take you and say, wait a minute, you know, the fact is it's money that goes with the kid. The kid's leaving. The district isn't providing the service anymore. But funding has been a thorn in the side. And I think this notion of coming up with a system where the funds actually are connected to the kids and aren't seen as being part either their district, but they're actually funds not for a system, but for kids. How we get there, I'm with Stephen. This is really hard. We don't really have rational conversations in Ohio around things like school funding, but we need to.
You know, and Ohio is different from other states that do charter. I mean, the charter wars aren't nearly as bad in other states. And a lot of that is a function of other states that have charter schools have a much larger state portion of funding, like places like New Mexico, where 85-88% of the money for education comes from the state because they have a large oil natural gas reserve and they use that to fund their schools. So when you transfer money, when the state transfers money to a school from a school district to a charter school, in that instance, you know, since they do provide such a heavy percentage, it's a little less problematic. When you do it in Ohio, the school district has to make that up with local property tax revenues. And as everybody knows, going to the ballot for new money is not exactly a very appetizing prospect for school districts at this point.
But it's important to note that when it comes to charters in the vast majority of districts, the local money doesn't go with the kids. It's the state money that goes. And so theoretically, you could have a school district that only has one child left and every dollar of the local pot would go to their education. So you could have a $20 million funding for one child who's left behind. So the point that charters are operating with less, the reason they're operating with less is because they're not getting local money. And they don't get any money for facilities either. So this would be a two-part conversation. It is absolutely, is there a way to do this that's fairer to districts, but is there also a way to do it that's fairer to charters?
Bob in Worthington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you. I have a number of questions, but one thing I'd like to know is a comparison between the different types of charter schools. It was mentioned at the head of the program that there were for-profits, there were public school charters, and that there were community schools. How do those three types of schools compare? And what about...
Well, wait,
school,
let's just go, take...
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, what do you mean? How do they compare, Bob, in
well,
what way? What do you mean?
There are various ways of comparison that have been cited. There have been mention of tests or reference to tests and such and going to the Ohio Department of Education website. There are the NEEP tests, and this, of course, the reason that I raised it is that it gets down to the real purpose, that the purpose of a profit school, for-profit school, must necessarily be for profit. The purpose of a community school, because I know some people who have been involved with them, was a kind of general dissatisfaction and a want to make the students have the students a special
opportunity. Okay, so what is your question?
My question is, how does the performance of those different types of schools, it was mentioned there was a huge disparity between the best and worst. How does the performance of those different types of schools compare?
Ida Liaskovsky or Molly Bloom, would you want to answer that one?
I actually think Molly got cut off. But I will say that I think it's difficult to generalize and say that, you know, this type of charter school sponsor does a really good job and that type of charter school sponsor does a really poor job. There are, you know, for-profit charter school operators that can do a good job and there are for-profit operators that do a not-so-good job. I don't think there's anything inherently about the type of charter school sponsor or management company that dictates what sort of job they do. That would probably be the least satisfactory but most honest mm-hmm. answer that I could give in that situation. I think it really depends on the different kind of group that is running those schools. I mean, of course, there's a nonprofit group, Breakthrough, that keeps coming up here in Cleveland, and all of their schools are excellent. Some of them are excellent with distinction, the ones that are already being rated on the report card. So obviously they do a fantastic job, and they're clearly doing something well. There are other groups that don't do such a great job. White Hat Management, which is probably the biggest for-profit group, none of their schools are higher than continuous improvement. But then again, they'll say their student population is a very difficult student population. A lot of their schools target students who have already dropped out of the regular public school district. So for them, continuous improvement is a good thing. So I guess it's not satisfactory, but you'd have to look at each school differently, I think.
Which is exactly the way we're always asked to look at the public schools, too. So how do you judge, Ida? How does an average parent who's working and busy and cares about their children, how do they even begin to plumb the depths of this discussion and get anything out of it?
Well, it is a very difficult world in education for Ohio parents to navigate through, I think, and they have my honest sympathy as an education reporter. It is complicated. I spoke to a group that started a charter school here in Ohio, a community that was one of those communities that the caller mentioned that were just dissatisfied with the local public school options and decided to start their own school. That happens to be a breakthrough school. It is sponsored by the Cleveland Metropolitan School District, and it's based on a very good model. And what they'll tell you is that for many of them, that decision is a really difficult one to make. And parents that live in urban areas often end up moving to suburban areas where the schools tend to be better academically. But I think that decision-making process is a multi-part one. I mean, you have to consider, like we talked about before, what is the safest for your student? Are you in a good area? Does the student have to walk far to the school? And then you also have to look at things like the report cards, which take a lot of things into account, like adequate yearly progress, how much has the school progressed over the course of the year, how many of the students in a particular class are at reading level or math level that they should be. So it is very difficult, and I think you can't really compare the school district to the individual school, though that is tempting. I think you have to really, you know, do some research on each school that you're considering looking into.
So tomorrow you're going to talk about that charter school that was opened in the Cleveland School District. And then on Wednesday, what's coming?
And then on Wednesday, we'll take a look at for-profit schools, some that have done not so well, some that have done well. And the idea that is there anything really wrong with, you know, making a profit off of running a school?
Well, thank you for joining us today to talk about your series and about charter schools in Ohio. Ida Liaskovsky, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Ida is with a Cleveland-based reporter for State Impact Ohio. Also, Molly Bloom, are you with us?
I'm here.
Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Molly Bloom is a Kent-based reporter for State Impact Ohio. Also with us, Stephen Dyer, Education Policy Fellow with Innovation Ohio. Thanks for joining us today, Stephen.
Sure.
And Terry Ryan, Vice President for Ohio Programs and Policy with the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and Foundation. Terry, thanks for joining us again.
Appreciate it.
And thanks for listening. When we come back, we're going to talk about Occupy Columbus. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Looking ahead next hour on All Sides with Ann Fisher, the Red Cross faces shortages and prepares for the baby boom generation. Guests will be Rodney Wilson of the Red Cross and Michael Daniels of Outlook Media.
On the next Fresh Air, we get Enlightened with Laura Dern, who stars in that new HBO series, along with executive producer Mike White. Dern plays a businesswoman who returns from a retreat after a very public meltdown to try and mend her fractured life. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air starts at 12 noon right here on 89.7 NPR News. In the weather forecast, well, we'll have partly sunny skies today, a high of about 81 degrees, low 55 tonight, tomorrow a high of 72. By tomorrow night, chance of showers and 56. Wednesday, chance of rain, cloudy, and a high of only about 70 degrees. Right now, it's 63.
Support for 89.7 comes from Thurber House, presenting Tatiana Soli, reading from her novel The Lotus Eaters, a love story during the fall of Saigon, Wednesday, October 12th at the Columbus Performing Arts Center. Tickets at thurberhouse.org.
Welcome back. 3 weeks ago, the Occupy Wall Street movement was barely a blip on the radar. NPR reporter Joel Rose said that's changed. Okay, well, we'll just move right on then. Joining us to talk about that is Tom Borgerding from WOSU. You were down at the State House today where they were starting their own Occupy Columbus.
Yeah, they got together for the holiday down there. There's about 80 to 90 people there just before 10 o'clock when they got started. It's fairly unorganized, though, Ann. And one of the protesters, I'm looking through my notes here, one of the protesters, Annabelle Coca, says no one's in charge. It's going to grow from the ground up. And they're mostly concerned about what they consider economic inequality in politics and in the day-to-day living.
What do you mean when you say they seem to be unorganized? What do you mean by that?
Well, when you ask, who might be a spokesman for them or who can give you a little bit of detail about what their plans are here in Columbus, I was referred to three or four different people. Some had lists. Others, said that, we're waiting for it to grow. And they were very, I don't want to say disorganized, but they were very very comfortable with chaos, I guess.
Okay. Also with us is Michael Stone. He's a spokesperson for the Occupy Columbus community. At 8 o'clock this morning, Occupy Columbus participants gathered at the State House. And Michael, you're with us now. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about that sense of organization. How important is that at this point in the game and or whatever you want to call it? And what you sense down at the State House right now?
Okay, well, we are a very young group of people. I guess you could say not in age alone, but also in organization and even knowing each other. So the unorganization that you're seeing is largely due to the fact that this is a leaderless movement, and most of the people who are down there. That's a very important aspect of what's going on for them. So if you want to see more organization, it's good to join us during a General Assembly, which we've had a couple of those up to this point. The previous two Tuesdays, we've had a General Assembly, and we will also have another one tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. at Bicentennial Park, which is at West Main Street and 2nd Street.
When you were saying General Assembly, and when I've been reading tweets and checking out Occupy Columbus, I kept getting confused because I must have covered the State House for too long, because they call the General Assembly of Ohio. That's what our state lawmakers' body is called. So tell me, what is the General Assembly?
Well, the General Assembly is basically a form of direct democracy. What they're using in New York right now is a kind of modified consensus model for decision making, and the way that we've been doing it here has been pretty loosely constructed as just majority rule. And tomorrow we hope to actually have everyone agree on a decision-making model. And so proposals will be given before the General Assembly, and we'll probably just go off consensus-based or majority decision-making, because we, of course, will have to assume a decision-making process as we decide one. So the whole point in that is to give everyone a voice. That's what the General Assembly is about, and that's why it's a form of direct democracy. And basically the way it works is we have a stack, which is kind of like a queue, and we can have a progressive stack, which is basically assigning some privilege to minorities who might otherwise feel intimidated by the situation mm-hmm. in which there are primarily white, affluent members of society getting up there who are more comfortable with speaking. But those are the kinds of things that get decided at the General Assembly. So we're in a very, very early stage of organization, and we have to make sure that people feel like they have a voice. That's one of the most important things about what's going on right now, is that we really want to more or less build community. And a lot of the people I think that are joining in this movement have felt disenfranchised for quite some time now by our political system. And so that's what I mean by community building. And the General Assembly, I think, does a good job of that, especially if we can keep it such that people are able to feel like they are welcome there and able to express their points of view and have at least a rough structure that keeps it orderly and allows everyone to get up there and speak their mind.
Tom Borgerding, you said that people seem pretty comfortable with the lack of organization. You call it chaos. I think you said that jokingly. But how many people are down there, and what are they doing?
Well, early on, when I got there just before 8 o'clock, there was just a handful of people, and it quickly grew to about 75 to 80 people by 9:30, quarter to 10. Talking to several folks, I mean, we got into discussions this morning about Jeffersonian democracy. One woman, Annabelle Coca, the woman I mentioned before, she's a private school teacher, and she mentioned Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations, and the fact that, in the early stages of the country, people were talking about acting in their own self-interest, and the tension between these self-interests would then work for a democracy or a republic, I guess. But it's pretty heavy discussions. Wolfgang Parker, he was an artist. He is an artist. He was there. He basically said that he fears the private sector more than he does a broke government. And the sensibility that I get is that in talking to these folks is that they see the political aspects of the society as not working. It's the same kind of complaint we've heard after the debt limit debate in Washington in early August, that, there was just no compromise. I mean, there seems to be that undertow also among some of the folks I talked to this morning in this group, that things are not working. And basically, this is an effort to create a voice, if you will.
Michael Stone, it's been said that some have said that Occupy Wall Street or Occupy Columbus or any of the Occupy movements now are just a tea party for Democrats. What do you make of that characterization?
Well, I think that is a misunderstanding of what's going on. I think that's actually something that's being imposed upon the group rather than a reflection of an observation. If someone was to actually go down there and have a more or less objective stance on what was going on, I don't think that would be the conclusion that one would draw. I can see why some people would think that, though. There are people down there who are... you might say, have left-leaning opinions, but there are also people down there that do not. So I just think that's actually a misrepresentation of the group.
Critics have said that a lot of these critics have come from the Tea Party movement, I might add, that I read, say that the aims of Occupy New York City or Occupy Wall Street, I should say, or Columbus are too loose, that there's not enough direction for the support and energy that has emerged, and that therefore it'll just dissipate over time. What do you make of that?
Well, I also think that that is a misunderstanding. So the nature of the movement is probably striking some people as being bizarre, perhaps because they don't understand that the protest itself can be the message. I would be highly surprised if any list of demands came out anytime soon. One reason for that is because the consensus-based model they're using is a very lengthy process. It takes some time to get a lot of people who are coming from a wide variety of political stances to come to agreement. And the modified consensus-based model allows for basically proposals to be blocked even by a single individual at some sometimes. So if you do have a very conservative or very radical opinion being represented, it's possible that it's kind of like a filibuster, I guess you could put it that way. But I've lost my train of thought.
Well, that's okay. Let's hear from Taylor in Columbus. You're on the air, Taylor. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Definitely appreciate you covering the story. And, Michael, actually, seen a couple of your Facebook posts and things. I've been following this online for a while. The comment that I wanted to make was that a lot of sort of the discussion gets lost or the point gets lost in the discussion. And a lot of people think like, oh, well, I'm a small business owner and I grew myself up from the ground and, you know, I'm successful and these people that are in the Occupy movement are sort of against me. Well, that's absolutely not the case. You know, a lot of it's been said that we're anti-profit, and that's totally not true. You know, this movement is not anti-profit. If you, you know, start a business and you do well and you provide great customer service and you make some money doing it, then you should absolutely be respected, and that's exactly what you should be doing. What this movement is against is corruption and people that use their profits to sort of buy politics and, you know, make things go their way when maybe not necessarily everyone in the country agrees with them. So I think that instead of focusing on like, oh, well, you guys are just pro-socialism or anti-profit, anti-capitalism, you know, that's definitely not where I'm coming from. And I think that's what a lot of people would agree with me is that, you know, this is not about being against profit, but about being against corruption. And if I could just say one other thing, I think a lot of people get sort of caught up in this, well, what's the end scenario? What's the goal of this? And I think instead of focusing necessarily so much on the goal, think about what it's already done. You know, this movement has started the conversation about greed and corruption of the top profit makers in the country. And, you know, that's an end, that's a goal in and of itself. So I think, you know, instead of thinking about, well, you're so unorganized, you can't get anything accomplished, you know, we already have accomplished the fact that now people are talking about this. And that's sort of the first step, in my opinion. So I appreciate your time, and thanks very much again for taking my call and covering the story.
You bet, Taylor. Thanks for calling. We just have a few more minutes. If you want to get a call in quick like Taylor did, 614-292-8513. One Tea Party activist, again, they seem to be where a lot of the criticism is coming from, Michael Stone, but they said that they've concluded that the Occupy Wall Street protests are being hijacked by interested parties, especially the unions. And I was wondering, what's your sense about what's happening in Columbus, and does that concern you?
Well, I think the hijacking is a concern. I've heard a number of people that are involved with this already expressing those concerns. I don't think, however, at this point in time that it's a real threat. Just because there are unions backing up some of what is going on doesn't mean that they're the ones setting the agenda. And in fact, if things go the way that they're supposed to go with the General Assembly, that actually won't be possible, because the General Assembly is to come to consensus about what it is exactly that we want to do. So, you know, if the union members come out and they overwhelm the General Assembly and it just turns into a big union meeting, then that's a concern. But it doesn't seem to me that that's going to be the case at all. And I think we're actually going to be addressing those issues tomorrow at the General Assembly and coming together to work on how we can avoid that concern or that problem.
Tom Borgerding, the Huffington Post, wrote about the social media aspects of the Occupy movement likening it to, in that respect, to the revolution in Egypt, for example. When you were downtown today, did you see people with their laptops? Did you see people tweeting? What did you see in regarding that?
You know, a lot of folks on their phones, either tweeting or maybe posting Facebook, things like that. But I also saw a lot of cardboard handwritten signs, and they're no megaphones. One thing I would mention, Ann, is that, you know, in walking around State House Square, went across the street talking to some folks coming out of the Huntington Bank during their break reaction. Some unaware, there was only one individual who would agree to speak on the record, a gentleman by the name of Bill Mackin. He said, you know, it's a free country. That's all he would say. And he kind of just smiled. It's a free country. But a lot of folks at the bus stop knew nothing about what the group was about or, you know, what the point of the protest was. So there is some general lack of awareness. There's also kind of an undertow. The Columbus police had brought four officers out there. There's an undertow of tension as to, you know, they don't know. You hear this word uncertainty all the time in the political debates, but there's uncertainty as to where this protest will go, whether it will grow in Columbus, and the police are keeping a watch on it, too. So,
Bert in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bert.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I just want to comment about the demonstration that's going on. First off, they talk about the this movement being anarchist. Well, it's not really different than what, you know, lack of leadership direction of the Tea Party. But the real issue here is in anti-capitalism. Well, I mean, that's not what this is about. If the banks were all that capitalistic, so to speak, they wouldn't have taken the money from TARP, our tax dollars. So it's, that in itself is a form of socialism. So the real issue for me in this is that you continue to have large financial institutions being propped up by the federal government, yet not paying back what they owe, and then continuing to raise our checking and savings fees, our credit card fees, our debit card fees. And it's got to stop somewhere, and the regulation that have been passed haven't even been enforced yet. But it just seems like they're able to. It just seems like they're able to set the rules and make the profits they want to make, which is okay, but they need to be fair. And I guess I'm just rambling, so that's fine.
That's okay, Bert. Thanks a lot for the call.
Yeah.
Michael Stone, just a little bit about a lot of the messages getting across in social media. Are people glomming onto the same message, or is it morphing as time goes on?
Well, from what I've seen in the media, they're trying to put a label on it, and it's not really justified by the evidence, I would say. You know, there are a lot of different views coming into this thing, people coming from all points on the political spectrum. And the reason why this thing is basically so ambiguous is because of the nature of what it's trying to be. And it's trying to be basically a discussion or a dialogue. That's why the occupation is kind of necessary. It's the creation of place and a kind of public forum, which we really don't have much of nowadays, mm-hmm. especially a person-to-person one. There's lots of different opinions coming into this thing, and I think that makes it great because there's a diversity of ideas coming in, and I think that creates better solutions. It's one of the reasons why America is a great country. We have a diversity of people coming together over the history of this country's existence.
Michael Stone, I'm sorry I have to call it there, but I want to thank you for joining us today.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Michael Stone, spokesperson for Occupy Columbus. They're down at the State House right now. It's also Tom Borgetting, WOSU. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we get Enlightened with Laura Dern, who stars in that new HBO series, along with executive producer Mike White. Dern plays a businesswoman who returns from a retreat after a very public meltdown to try and mend her fractured life. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air coming up at 12 noon today here on 89.7 NPR News.
Some 44,000 pints of blood are needed every single day in the United States.
The need is constant. So is the struggle to meet that need. Coming up, we'll hear how the Red Cross does the job or not, what has changed to impact the need for blood, including the aging of the baby boomer generation. We'll also hear about a new blood drive on behalf of gay men, many of whom are banned from giving blood. All that's coming up after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.